Okay, speak.
Keep it fixed. This
is tape number 16. And the date is what? What is this date? November the 17th, 1959.
President, one thing I'd like to talk to you about is the so-called Battle of the Generals that we have seen. The end of the war, in which generals have accused each other of either ineptitude or difficulties in carrying out of campaigns. What is your overall impression of this?
It's customary. You never want to let it worry you. It started back, way back in the beginning of history. You'll find the difficulties between Caesar and Pompey and all the rest of those great men of that time were exactly what they were between the generals of the Revolutionary War, and there was only one man in the Revolutionary War that they couldn't attack. And they charged him with doing things that could have been done better by somebody else, and they almost fired him at one time. And that thing was true, that same situation was true in the war with Mexico.
Excuse me, Mr. President, what general were you referring to, the Revolutionary
Washington.
War?
Washington. General Washington, he's the only one that they couldn't upset, and then they abused him like a pickpocket after that. That the same situation developed in the Mexican War between Winfield Scott and Zachariah Taylor. And in the war between the states, Lincoln had to fire five generals. And the only man who stayed through the whole difficulty was Robert E. Lee. And every effort has been made to debunk him, and it had no luck in doing it. The same thing was true with Stonewall Jackson. They found fault with what he did. They found fault with Sherman, and they found fault with all the other generals who were mixed up in that war. And if you remember in the Spanish-American War, the admirals got into a fuss, Admiral Sampson, Admiral Sly, as to who won the Battle of Santiago. It didn't make a bit of difference. They won the battle. But they talked about it, I think, for 10 years. And the same thing, of course, will happen in the has happened in the First World War, but not to such an extent, because we weren't there long enough to cause trouble. We were only there at the final windup of that war, and General Pershing was in complete command, and he did a whale of a good job. Nobody could throw many bricks at him, although some people tried. And in the Second World War, where all the Allies were mixed up in it, General Montgomery and this General Allenby, who decided that somebody else didn't do what was right, General Eisenhower, you'll find that this controversy will go on indefinitely. And then when history is written, the facts in all probability will come out and we'll find out who really did the job.
Well, Mr. President, have you any opinion about any of the leading generals or admirals of this Second World War?
I certainly have. My opinion of General Marshall is that he was the brains and the man who really made the military organization work, both in the Pacific and in the Atlantic.
What about some of the Allied officers?
Well, the Allied officers were all good men, but of course you must understand that when the newest of the Allies, the United States, was put in complete command of the situation, it was a hard pill to swallow. For those men who knew that there was no military talent in the United States, but they were fooled, they were mistaken, and they're going to keep talking about it for a long, long time to come. But I don't think it'll do any harm to the reputations of those men who really made great contributions to the winning of war. That's particularly true of General Marshall and General Bradley and General Eisenhower.
What is your feeling about General Eisenhower as a man, as a soldier?
He was a good soldier. He did a good job. He coordinated the Allies, kept them together, made the crossing of the Channel and the landing in South Africa, and came out of this situation, I think, in very, very good shape.
What about any of the admirals of the war?
Admiral Nimitz was the greatest of the admirals in the war. Eddie King was the chief of naval operations. Cranky old man, and I used to have difficulty with him all the time, but he did the best he could, and I think, handled the Navy in good shape. But the greatest of the admirals is Admiral Nimitz.
Well, how much do you think that generals are able, or admirals are able, to plan out in advance the conduct of a war? Don't they also have to be subject to the whims of events and unexpected events, especially?
There isn't any question about that. But they're the only ones who are capable of working out a military program with the idea of winning the objective which they have in view, which in this last war was to wind up Japan and Germany in such a way that they could not do what they did again.
Mr. President, do you recall at this moment anything about what General Marshall may have said to you, which you haven't so far talked about?
Well, General Marshall was always in conference with me right straight along before the Germans surrendered, which they did a very short time after I took over. And then General Marshall went to China and did a wonderful job over there. If he'd had the right support from the bureaus and back home, I think he would have been successful in that program. Then he became Secretary of State and did a remarkable job for me. He became Secretary of Defense, and he was one of the ablest administrators that I ever came in contact with who had a military background.
What was his character, if you describe it at all?
He was absolutely reliable. He was an honorable man, and his word was just as good as his bond, and he never forgot what he said.
Didn't you try to persuade him to leave a record or a memoir?
I sure did. I tried to get him to go ahead and arrange things so the facts could be known, the conditions through which he had to go when he was Chief of Staff of the United States, and really Chief of Staff for all the Allies, as far as that goes. But he never would do it. He was of the opinion that the facts would come out. But long toward the last, after they began to attack him politically, he had made up his mind that he'd go ahead with it, but he didn't live long enough to finish.
Was he pretty frail when he left the left the service?
Oh, he was, yes. Yes, he had been in bad health for quite some time, long before he retired. And then when I called him back into service, he had a great many difficulties physically, but it never affected his mind in any way.
You went to see him at his home several times since his retirement.
That's right.
Anything occur there while you were with him?
Oh, we always had the warmest of associations, and we spent a great deal of time talking about things that had happened and the misinformation that had been put out in regard to some of them. That was the reason I was very anxious for General Marshall to set down his viewpoint from his position. And I'm as sorry as I can be that he didn't have a chance to.
Did he have anything to say to you about his protege and your successor?
No, he never talked about individuals. If I'd ask him a point blank question, he'd answer me with two or three words as to whether I could rely or I couldn't rely, and that's all he ever said.
Didn't he get somebody to take down some notes from him, or did he take
some notes? Yes, he did. The papers and all the things that were accumulated in General Marshall's office from the time that he started with General Pershing back in the First World War are accumulated at the Virginia Military Institute. And there's been a gentleman in charge down there who's been working to coordinate those things, and he was the one that was working with General Marshall, which in the manner which we hoped would be General Marshall's memoirs, but they never got it finished.
May I ask you now about Secretary of Stimson? What was your opinion of him?
He was a great man. Secretary Stimson was one of the men who understood the world situation as well or better than anybody I came in contact with, and he was absolutely honorable, and you could rely entirely on what he told you. I can give you an instance of this. I was making investigations in the Senate as chairman of that committee to investigate the National Defense Program. I found out the United States government was spending immense amounts of money at Pasco, Washington, and down in Tennessee on the Manhattan Project. and I sent some investigators to take a look and see what they were doing. Secretary Stinson called me up and said that he would like to talk to me about the situation. I told him that I would be glad to come down and see him. He said, no, I don't want you to do that. I'll come down to your office. He came down and told me of the importance of this project and that it could cause an immense amount of difficulty if anything should occur that would put it into the limelight. And I said, all right, Mr. Secretary, if you tell me that the thing ought not to be looked into at this time, I'll follow your suggestion. And that's just exactly what I did, and I made no mistake because that brought forth the atomic bomb.
He was the first one to see you after you became president with regard to it. The second one, Burns, was the first.
It's hard to tell who the first person I saw was after I became president. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was the Secretary of State, Mr. Stettinius. And then, of course, I called all the cabinet members in before the swearing-in ceremony took place, and then we had a cabinet meeting right afterwards, which was made up of all the members of the cabinet that had served as Mr. Roosevelt.
Why did Secretary of War leave your service?
Because of his health. He didn't live very long after he left. And he left under my protest. I didn't want him to go, but he had a man who was Under Secretary of War who was a very able person, and that was Bob Patterson. And he served with me for a long time after that, and I had just as much confidence in him as I did any other cabinet member.
Continue your relations with Secretary Stinson after he left the service?
Oh, yes. We were in correspondence on various things all the time, confirming things that had happened, pro and con. And I have quite a file of correspondence with Secretary Stinson.
You consider him to be the mastermind behind the development of the atomic bomb more so than anyone else in the Roosevelt administration?
I can't answer that because I was not familiar with the development of the atomic bomb until after I became president. And Einstein and half a dozen other the great scientists were mixed up in it. Of course, the program had to be carried on under the direction of the Secretary of War because it was a military project. But all these people were equally informed on the subject on the inside. And I didn't know anything about it until after I had become President of the United States. They had a committee on the Atomic Energy Program, that's what they called it. And Secretary Stinson, of course, being the Secretary of War, and Secretary Patterson, who was the Under Secretary of War, were those most intimately connected with it from the viewpoint of decision making. But there were a great many scientists who were brought over here, both from England, from Denmark, from France, who worked on the development of the breaking of the atom. And I don't think you can justly say that any single one of them was the man who really did the job. It took a combination of all of them.
Nevertheless, looking back at it now, as you have done frequently, you think this is one of the greatest gambles and one of the most courageous gambles of Mr. Roosevelt.
That's undoubtedly true. Mr. Roosevelt, of course, as the President of the United States, is the one who put the energy into all these people I've been naming. And there was the expenditure of $2.6 billion before the first bomb went off. And had it not been that we were in the midst of a tremendous emergency, it never could have been done. And there's no private enterprise or individual that could have brought about the development of the breaking of the atom but the government of the United States under a president who was willing to take the chance and get it done.
Do you think that the government should continue as it does in TWA to develop atomic energy?
Yeah, TVA, yes, of course. I've said in an article which you just had published in the North American Newspaper Alliance that experiments ought to continue. And I think they ought, because unless those experiments continue, how in the world are we ever going to come to the position where we can make use of this tremendous source of power in peacetime, for peacetime purposes, and it can be done, I'm sure of that.
I would like to direct your thoughts in another direction for a second. You've been an officer in the First World War, so you directly engaged personally in combat. Involved in the conclusion of the Second World War, the end of the European War, and the final conclusion in the Pacific. You had to direct the use, the historic use of the dropping of atomic bombs. You had to re-engage in a protective operation in Korea. You've been through a lot of war. And you've also been very closely and intimately identified with the instrumentality of peace, the United Nations, and the Marshall Plan, the Truman. You've been on both sides of the fence. How do you reflect upon civilization's constant resorting to war, desperately trying for peace, never quite getting it, and now we find that as we wage a battle for the atom, we do it out of a military necessity, out of a war necessity. We're having a little difficulty keeping it going in peacetime. And are we so organized, and this is the heart of the question, that we can only make important progress directly related to war and as a consequence of war? Now, you've been through all
I think that's a necessity and has always been the case. If you remember, this great Swedish foundation was on the discovery of dynamite. And the old man who set up that foundation thought he brought forth something that would absolutely ruin the world, but it's been used more often and more thoroughly and for the welfare and benefit of the people as a peacetime instrument. The same thing will happen with this, but emergencies bring forth these things. And if you have a man at the controls who understands the things with which we're faced, then he'll go ahead and get the job done, just to show himself did in the discovery of how to break the atom. And now, eventually, we're going to use that source, great source of power, just as we use dynamite for the benefit and welfare of peacetime. You know, the first time that artillery was ever used in a battle was down in Italy, between some of those counts down there who were always fighting with each other to see who should control Italy. And they hanged the artillerymen the first time they used the guns for the simple reason this was unethical to have a weapon that could shoot the armor off the night.
Do you think, Mr. President, abolition of weapons could lead to an abolition of war?
No, I do not. I do not. For the simple reason that if you're going to have a premise like that, why don't you fire all the police and take the guns away from them?
In other words, wars grow out of the inability of people to resolve their differences.
That's right. That's the only reason for them.
Is this part of nature? What is the human element, animal, incapable of ever adopting peaceful ways?
We're always hopeful that that'll come about, but I don't think we've reached that millennium yet. I'm sincerely hoping that sometime or other it will be reached, but it's a difficult program with which we're always faced, because there have always been two forces in the world, what we call good and evil. And you find that all the great philosophies in the world are founded on the premise that the good will finally prevail. And generally it does. Sometimes it doesn't. But you've got to be in position to meet these evil forces like Hitler and Mussolini and Franco and this old man down here in San Domingo. There isn't any difference between those people. They don't care what they do to people as long as they can maintain the power with which to run things to suit themselves and not for the welfare and benefit of their inhabitants.
What do you think, Mr. President, of this continuous exposure of mankind to the horrors of war? They don't seem to learn about these horrors from one generation to another.
No, they don't. And that brings me to one thing that I've always been thinking about. If the things that are of the most good could be carried through from the experience of the previous generation. We eventually approach a millennium. The main difficulty is that the youngsters always think that the old folks didn't know what they were doing anyhow, and they have to go through the same experience, and that's the reason we have every once in a while a debacle in the world in the form of a war. And now we've reached a point where if we have any such a program, there won't be anybody left to carry on what comes later.
What is at the bottom of it? Is it the rich versus the poor? Is it strong versus the weak? What's doing it?
Well, it's the great ambitions of certain men who bring these things about. One of the greatest leaders in the history of the world was Genghis Khan, who started from a little Mongolian tribe up in North China, took over the Chinese Empire, and started out on a world conquest, and got as far as Vienna. And then he was turned back, went back into Siberia, and died there. But he set up a program and a dynasty which lasted through three or four generations. Kublai Khan was the emperor of China when Marco Polo went over there and found out what a great country it was. The West had never heard of China, didn't know anything about it. And that was one of the things that brought about Columbus's voyage towards the West. He hoped to hit India and China by going west. He thought he had hit it when he got to San Salvador, but he was mistaken.
Mr. President, Dave had a suggestion. You have named those presidents that you thought were strong and those that were not so strong. Would you mind looking back over history now quickly, Dave's suggestion? Who was a great justice of the United States?
There were a great many of those justices, but they are in the same fix as a great many of the presidents. Their policy and program has never been followed through. Now, the only reason we know so much about Chief Justice Marshall was because Senator Beveridge of Indiana took a personal interest in it and wrote a biography of him, which has made him one of the famous justices. We've had a great many other great justices, and we know very little about it. But the present Chief Justice is now trying to get that worked out so that we'll know who were the great justices of the court during its period of operation from 1789 to today. And we'll find out a great many things about the justices of the court that we're not now familiar with, because that is a dry subject. When the court makes a decision on a majority vote and they all turn in opinions, you never know which one is correct, and only the technical lawyers ever look at those decisions. I'm sincerely hoping that when Chief Justice Warren gets through with the project that he has in view, that we'll know a lot more about the court than we do now.
Well, how do you account for an ostensibly impartial body taking two opposing attitudes, one being conservative and the other liberal, and was accentuated by the famous theme of Holmes and Brandeis?
Well, that's part of our system of government. Well, just as we were talking about the fact that both parties in our two-party system are made up of all branches of thought, from liberal to conservative, and it's good for the country. And the arguments that those justices have over the decision that they have to make is one of the best things that happens in this country.
Well, now, is the Constitution a conservative document or is it a liberal document, according to your judgment?
It's both. It depends on its interpretation. It took the court a long time to find certain words in the Constitution which made it a liberal document. It didn't take some of the courts very long to decide that it was a document for the benefit of special privilege. And those things are good for the country because we try by trial and experience to find out what's best for the country, and that's the way to do it. You can't do it if you have somebody whose final word is law.
Was it made deliberately flexible, subject to the adjustment of the Constitution to the times, or did it work out that way?
I think it worked out that way. I think the intention of the man who wrote the Constitution was to have a document that would be a lasting instrument of government, and it has been. But I don't think they had any more idea than we have today of what the future will bring forth, of how the Constitution would finally work out. It's worked out to be one of the greatest documents of government that ever was written, and it was founded on the knowledge of these men who wrote it, of government which had previously existed, and their objective was to make a free government with an instrument that had a certain number of checks and balances in it so that no one man could get control and turn himself into a dictator. And that hasn't happened in this period of time from 1789 until now. It's the oldest existing government in the world, founded on the greatest document of government, in my opinion, that ever was written.
Well, how do you...
Go ahead, Dave.
How do you feel about the Congress deliberately initiating legislation to override the opinions of the court?
They do that all the time. You see, the court decides on the wording which the congressman put into law. And when the congressman changed the wording of the law in such a way that it may meet conditions that they think were not met in the first law, then the court goes along with them. But the Congress should never have the right categorically to override the decisions of the court. I made that statement the other day when I told these youngsters over here at Liberty that if you wanted to give the Congress the authority to override the court in the decisions that they made, we wouldn't have any court. And it's set up that way purposely so that could not be done. And they'd have to have a constitutional amendment to do it. And I think the people of the United States have too much sense to pass a constitutional amendment like that.
Mr. President, do you think adequate justice has been done to the lives of all the presidents in the recordings of their lives?
No, I don't. No, I do not. And one of the shining examples is the life of Andrew Johnson. Had it not been for Stracker's willingness to go ahead and make a tremendous amount of research and put out his life of Andrew Johnson, people would have always had a wrong impression of Andrew Johnson as the president of the United States. He's one of the great ones because he was in a terrifically bad position. He was elected on the American Union ticket of Lincoln. He was a Democrat. Now, Lincoln was a Whig or a Republican of that day. And when he took over, they had a bunch of radicals in the Congress headed by old Fat Stevens, the old cripple moron is what I call him, whose objective was to persecute the states who had attempted to leave the Union. And Andrew Johnson wanted to carry out the policies of Abraham Lincoln and did his best to do that. He was a constitutional president. He knew more about the Constitution of the United States, I think, than any other president up to his time.
And you feel that there are still a lot of papers and documents and records which ought to be exhausted in telling the lives of
there
the
isn't any doubt about that. The papers of the president ought to be thoroughly studied in the manner in which Stracker studied the background and the history of Andrew Johnson. If every president had that sort of treatment, we'd know the facts completely. Mostly our facts come from newspaper reports, a great many of them hostile to the president who was in the office. And it's going to take a long time to get the proper approach to the history of the presidents of the United States. That's the reason we're setting up this institution here, in the hope that that can be done.
Now, actually, the history of the United States evolved and revolved around the personalities and the lives of presidents from our beginning.
There's any question about that. It also evolved from the leaders of the Congress. Some of them were great leaders. Some of them weren't worth being in the Congress, but they got into positions of responsibility. It also was a part of the history of the country. When you get the history of the courts that we were talking about a while ago, I think you find that when you have all the knowledge in connection with the various presidential administrations, the Congresses with which they had to deal, and the decisions of the courts in their time, we'll have a much better view of what the government of the United States needs. It survived all these things, and that's the reason I think it's a great government.
Well, to get back to the United States in terms of the peace role, the United States is perhaps the only nation in history, as we recall it, that had not, during its greatest period of strength, resorted to expansion of territory, to the invasion of neighbors, and to the colonizations of anybody. And as far as it is evident now, it's been the greatest evolved force for peace
that
history has known. And
that's
this
right.
has happened during the administrations of Franklin Roosevelt and yourself. Don't you feel that its role in that sense is unique as perhaps the first really important power that has grown on the slope that may check a tendency of the war makers to use war for aggression, expansion? You've done it in Korea as a move. How do you feel about America's future role in terms of the peacemaker of the world?
I think it can be if the objective is always kept in mind that the strength of the peacemaker must be such as to enforce the peace when it's necessary. That's the only way in the world that an organization or government can operate, especially when you have people in the world whose objective is to follow through on the same program that Tamerlane and Genghis Khan and Napoleon and all the rest of them followed.